scrape of a chair, and how loud, despite the greasy tiles, they sound down here, like the bark of a dog. John Cairncross rises to his feet. He assumes again a friendly tone. Trudy, it's been... But she's standing too, and thinking fast. I feel it in her sinews, in the stiffening drapes of her omentum. She has one last throw, and everything rests on an easiness of manner. She cuts him off in a rush of sincerity. John, before you go, I want to tell you this. I know I can be difficult, sometimes even a bitch. More than half the blame for all this is mine, I know that. And I'm sorry the house is a tip. But what you said last night, about Dubrovnik...
Ah, my father affirms. Dubrovnik.
But he's already several feet away.
What you said was right. You brought it all back to me, and it pierced my heart. It was a masterpiece, John, what we created. What's happened since doesn't lessen it. You were so wise to say that. It was beautiful. Nothing that happens in the future can wash it away. And even though it's only water in my glass, I want to raise it to you, to us. And thank you for reminding me. It doesn't matter whether love endures. What matters is that it exists. So, to love. Our love, as it was. And to Elodie.
Trudy lifts the glass to her lips. The rise and fall of her epiglottis and her snaky peristalsis briefly deafen me. In all the time I've known her, I've never heard my mother make a speech. Not her way. But curiously evocative. Of what? A nervous schoolgirl. The new head girl making an impression with defiant tremor, emphatic platitudes before headmaster, staff and the whole school. A toast to love, and therefore death. To Eros and Thanatos. It appears to be a given of intellectual life that when two notions are sufficiently far apart or opposed, they are said to be profoundly linked. Since death is opposed to everything in life, various couplings are proposed. Art and death. Nature and death. Worryingly, birth and death. And, joyously iterated, love and death. On this last, and from where I am, no two notions could be more mutually irrelevant. The dead love no one, nothing. As soon as I'm out and about, I might try my hand at a monograph. The world cries out for fresh-faced empiricists. When my father speaks, he sounds closer. He's coming back to the table. Well, he says, most genially, that's the spirit. I swear the deathly loving cup is in his hand. Again, with both heels, I kick and kick against his fate.
Oh, little mole,
my mother calls out in a sweet maternal voice.
He's waking up.
You fail to mention my brother, John Cairncross says. It's in his manly poet's nature to amplify another's toast. To our future loves, Claude and Elodie.
To us all, then, says Claude.
A silence. My mother's glass is already empty. Then comes my father's drawn-out sigh of satisfaction, exaggerated to a degree merely out of politeness.
More sugary than usual, but not bad at all.
The styrofoam cup he sets upon the table makes a hollow sound. It comes back to me, as bright as a cartoon light bulb. A program on pet care laid out the dangers while Trudy was brushing her teeth one rainy morning after breakfast. Unlucky the dog that licks the sweet green liquid off a garage floor. Dead within hours, just as Claude told it. Chemistry without mercy, purpose, or regrets. My mother's electric toothbrush drowned out the rest. We're bound by the same rules that dog our pets. The great chain of non-being is round our necks, too.
Well, my father says, meaning more than he can know, I'll be going.
Claude and Trudy stand. This is the reckless thrill of the poisoner's art.
the substance ingested, the act not yet complete. Within 2 miles of here are many hospitals, many stomach pumps, but the line of criminality has been crossed. No calling in the deed. They can only stand back and wait for the antithesis, for the antifreeze to leave him cold. Claude says,
"Is this your hat?"
"Oh, yes, I'll take that. Is this the last time I hear my father's voice?" We're moving towards the stairs, then up them, the poet leading the way. I have lungs, but no air to shout a warning or weep with shame at my impotence. I'm still a creature of the sea, not a human like the others. Now we're passing through the shambles of the hall. The front door is opening. My father turns to give my mother a peck upon the cheek and throw an affectionate punch at his brother's shoulder, perhaps for the first time in his life. As he goes out, he calls over his shoulder, "Let's hope that bloody car starts."
11. A pale, thin plant, seeded by drunks in the small hours, struggles for the remote sunlight of success. Here's the plan. A man is found lifeless at his steering wheel. On the floor of his car, by the rear seat, almost out of sight, is a styrofoam cup bearing the logo of a business in Judd Street near Camden Town Hall. In the cup, the remains of a pureed fruit drink laced with glycol. Near the cup, an empty bottle of the same lethal substance. Near the bottle, a discarded receipt for the drink bearing that day's date. Concealed under the driver's seat, a few bank statements, some for a small publishing house, others for a personal account. Both show overdrafts in the low tens of thousands. On one of the statements is scrawled, in the handwriting of the deceased, the word, "Enough." Trudy's thing. By the bank statements, a pair of gloves the dead man wore now and then to conceal his psoriasis. They partly conceal a balled-up newspaper page bearing a hostile review of a recent volume of poems. On the front passenger seat, a black hat. The Metropolitan Police are understaffed, overstretched. The younger detectives, so the older complain, investigate at their screens, reluctant to waste shoe leather. When there are other gory cases to pursue, a conclusion in this is conveniently at hand. The means unusual, but not rare, easily available, palatable, fatal in large doses, and a well-known resource for crime writers. Inquiry suggests that as well as debts, the marriage was in trouble, the wife now living with the brother of the dead man, who had been depressed for months. Psoriasis undermined his confidence. The gloves he wore to conceal it explains the absence of fingerprints on the cup and the antifreeze bottle. CCTV images show him at Smoothie Heaven wearing his hat. He was on his way to the home in St. John's Wood that morning. Apparently, he couldn't face becoming a father, or the collapse of his business, or his failure as a poet, or his loneliness in Shoreditch, where he was living in rented accommodation. After a row with his wife, he left in distress. The wife blames herself. The interview with her had to be suspended a few times. The brother of the dead man was also present, and did his best to be helpful. Is reality so easily, so minutely arranged in advance? My mother, Claude, and I are waiting tensely at the open front door. Between the conception of a deed and its acting out lies a tangle of hideous contingencies. At the first touch, the engine turns but does not start. No surprise. This vehicle belongs to a dreaming sonneteer. On the second attempt, the same wheezing failure, and so too on the third. The starter motor is sounding like an old man grown too feeble to clear his throat. If John Cairncross dies on our hands, we'll all go down. Likewise, if he survives on our hands. He pauses before trying again, gathering his luck. The fourth is weaker than the third. I conjure a view of him through the car's windscreen, mimicking for us a quizzical shrug, his form almost obliterated by reflections of summer clouds.
"Oh dear," says Claude, a man of the world. "He's going to flood the carb."
My mother's viscera orchestrate her desperate hopes.
but on the fifth, a transformation. With slow heaving and comical popping sounds, the engine internally combusts. Trudy and Claude's straggling plant grows a hopeful bud. As the car reverses into the road, my mother has a fit of coughing from what I take to be a cloud of blue exhaust blowing our way. We come inside, and the door is slammed shut. We're not returning to the kitchen, but climbing the stairs. Nothing is said, but the quality of silence, creamily thick, suggests that more than fatigue and drink are drawing us towards the bedroom. Misery on misery. This is savage injustice. 5 minutes later. This is the bedroom, and it's already started. Claude crouches by my mother, and might already be naked. I hear his breath on her neck. He's undressing her. To date, a peak of sensual generosity, unscaled by him.
Careful, Trudy says. Those buttons are pearls.
He grunts in reply. His fingers are inexpert, working solely for his own needs. Something of his or hers lands on the bedroom floor, a shoe or trousers with heavy belt. She's writhing strangely, impatience. He issues a command in the form of a second grunt. I'm cowering. This is ugly, sure to go wrong, too late in my term. I've been saying this for weeks. I'll suffer. Obediently, Trudy's on all fours. It's a posteriori, doggy style, but not for my sake. Like a mating toad, he clasps himself against her back, on her, now in her, and deep. So little of my treacherous mother separates me from the would-be murderer of my father. Nothing is the same this Saturday noon in St. John's Wood. This is not the usual brief and frantic encounter that might threaten the integrity of a brand new skull, rather a glutinous drowning, like something pedantic crawling through a swamp. Mucous membranes slide past each other with a faint creak on the turn. Hours of scheming have accidentally delivered the conspirators into the art of deliberative lovemaking. But nothing passes between them. Mechanically, they churn in slow motion, a blind industrial process at half power. All they want is release. To clock out, taste a few seconds' respite from themselves. When it comes, in close succession, my mother gasps in horror at what she must return to and might yet see. Her lover emits his third grunt of the shift. They fall apart to lie on their backs on the sheets. Then we all sleep. On and on, through the afternoon. And it's on this long, flat stretch of time that I have my first dream, in full colour and rich visual depth. The line, the stated border, between dreaming and waking, is vague. No fences or firebreak in the trees, only vacant sentry huts mark the crossing. I begin indistinctly in this new land, as a tyro must, with a formless mass or mess of wavering ill-lit shapes, people and places dissolving, indistinct voices in vaulted spaces singing or speaking. As I pass through, I feel the pain of unnamed, unreachable remorse, a sense of having left someone or something behind in a betrayal of duty or love. Then it comes beautifully clear. A cold mist on the day of my desertion, a 3-day journey on horseback, long rows of the sullen English poor in the rutted lanes, giant elms looming over flooded meadows by the Thames, and at last the familiar thrill and din of the city. In the streets, the odour of human waste as solid as house walls, yielding around a narrow corner to the aroma of roasted meat and rosemary, and a drab entranceway I pass through to see a young man of my age in the dark-beamed gloom at a table pouring wine from an earthenware jug, a handsome man, leaning in across a smeared oak table, holding me with a tale he has in mind,
something he has written, or I have, and wants an opinion, or to give one, a correction, a point of fact. Or he wants me to tell him how to go on. This blurring of identity is one aspect of the love I feel for him, which almost smothers the guilt I want to leave behind. Outside in the street, a bell tolls. We crowd outside to wait for the funeral cortege. We know this is an important death. The procession doesn't appear, but the bell keeps ringing. It's my mother who hears the doorbell. Before I've drifted upwards from the novelty of dream logic, she's in her dressing gown and we're descending the stairs. As we reach the last run, she gives a cry of surprise. I would guess the midden has been cleared while we slept. The bell sounds again, loud, hard, angry. Trudy is opening the door as she shouts, "For God's sake, are you drunk? I'm going as fast as..." She falters. If she has faith in herself, she shouldn't be astonished to see what dread has already let me see. A policeman. No, two. Removing their hats. A kind, fatherly voice says, "Are you Mrs. Cairncross, wife of John?" She nods. "Sergeant Crowley, I'm afraid we have some very bad news. May we come in?" "Oh, God," my mother remembers to say. They follow us into the sitting room, rarely used and almost clean. If the hallway hadn't been cleared, I think my mother would have been an immediate suspect. Police work is intuitive. What remains, possibly, is a lingering smell, easily confused with exotic cooking. A second voice, younger, with brotherly solicitude, says, "We'd like you to be sitting down." The sergeant breaks the news. Mr. Cairncross's car was reported on the hard shoulder of the M1 northbound, 20 miles from London. His door was open, and not far off, on a grassy embankment, he lay face down. An ambulance came, resuscitation was attempted during the race to hospital, but he died along the way. A sob, like an air bubble in deep water, rises through my mother's body, rises through me, to burst into the faces of the attentive police.
"Oh, God!"
she shouts.
"We had the most awful row this morning."
She hunches forward. I feel her put her hands to her face and start to shiver. "I should tell you this," the same policeman continues. He pauses delicately, mindful of the double respect owed to the heavily pregnant bereaved. "We tried to contact you this afternoon. A friend of his identified the body. I'm afraid our first impression is suicide." When my mother straightens her spine and lets out a cry, I'm overcome by love for her, for all that's lost. Dubrovnik, poetry, daily life. She loved him once, as he her. Summoning this fact, erasing others, lifts her performance.
I should have kept him here. Oh my God, it's all my fault.
How clever. Hiding in plain sight, behind the truth. The sergeant says, "People often say that, but you mustn't, you shouldn't. It's wrong to go blaming yourself." A deep inhalation and sigh. She seems about to speak, stops, sighs again, gathers herself.
"I ought to explain. Things weren't going well between us. He was seeing someone, he moved out, and I started her. His brother moved in with me. John took it badly. That's why I'm saying..."
She's got in first with Claude, told them what they were bound to discover. If, in flagrant mood, she were to say now,
"I killed him,"
she'd be safe. I hear the rasp of Velcro, the flip of notebook page, the scratch of pencil. She tells them, in dulled voice, all that she'd rehearsed, returning at the end to her own culpability. She should never have let him drive away in such a state. The younger man says, reverentially, "Mrs. Cairncross, you weren't to know." Then she changes tack, almost sounds cross,
I don't think I'm taking this in. I'm not even sure I believe you.
That's understandable. This is the paternal sergeant. With polite coughs, he and his colleague stand ready to leave. Is there someone you can call? Someone who can be with you? My mother considers her reply. She's bent over again, face in hands. She speaks through her fingers in a flat voice.
My brother-in-law's here now. He's upstairs, asleep.
The guardians of the rule of law might be exchanging a lewd glance. Any token of their scepticism would help me. When the time's right, we'd like a word with him as well, the younger one says.
This news is going to kill him.
I expect you'd like to be alone together now. There it is again, the slender lifeline of insinuation to support my cowardly hope that the Force, Leviathan, not I, will take revenge. I need a moment alone, beyond the reach of voices. I've been too absorbed, too impressed by Trudy's art to peer into the pit of my own grief. And beyond it, the mystery of how love for my mother swells in proportion to my hatred. She's made herself my only parent. I won't survive without her, without the enveloping green gaze to smile into, the loving voice pouring sweets in my ear, the cool hands tending my private parts. The constabulary leave. My mother mounts the stairs with a plodding tread, hand firmly on the banister. 1-2 and pause, 1-2 and pause. She's making a repeated humming sound on a fading note, a moan of pity or sadness exhaled through her nostrils. I know her. Something's building, a prelude to a reckoning. She devised a plot, pure artifice, a malign fairy tale. Now her fanciful story is deserting her, crossing the border as I did this afternoon, but in reverse, past the watchless guard huts, to rise against her and side with the socially real, the dull quotidian of the working day world, of human contacts, appointments, obligations, video cameras, computers with inhuman memories. In short, consequences. The tale has turned tail. Hammered by drink and lost sleep, bearing me upwards, she continues towards the bedroom.
It was never meant to work, she's telling herself. It was just my foolish spite. I'm only guilty of a mistake.
The next step is close, but she won't take it yet. 12. We are advancing on slumbering Claude, a hump, a bell curve of sound baffled by bedclothes. On the exhalation, a long, constipated groan, its approaching terminus frilled with electric sibilance. Then an extended pause which, if you loved him, might alarm you. Has he breathed his last? If you don't, there's hope he has. But finally, a shorter, greedy intake, scarred with the rattle of wind-dried mucus, and at the breezy summit, the soft palate's triumphant purr. The rising volume announces we are very close. Trudy says his name. I feel her hand extend towards him while he's on a downward plunge through the sibilance. She's impatient. She needs to share their success, and her touch on his shoulder isn't gentle. He coughs into half-life, like his brother's car, and takes some seconds to find the words to pose his question.
What the fuck?
He's dead.
Who?
Jesus, wake up!
Drawn from the deepest phase of sleep, he has to sit on the edge of the bed, so the complaining mattress says, and wait for his neural circuitry to restore him to the story of his life. I'm young enough not to take such wiring for granted. So, where was he? Ah, yes, attempting to murder his brother. Truly dead? Finally, he's Claude again.
Well, blow me down.
Now he feels like getting up. It's 6 p.m., he notes. Enlivened, he stands, stretches his arms athletically with a creak of bone and gristle, then moves between bedroom and bathroom
cheerily whistling, with full vibrato. From the light music I've heard, I know this to be the theme tune from Exodus. Grandiose, in a corrupted romantic style to my newly formed ear, redemptive orchestral poetry to Claude's. He's happy. Meanwhile, Trudy sits in silence on the bed. It's brewing. At last, in dulled monotone, she tells him of the visit, the kindness of the police, the discovery of the body, the early presumption as to cause of death. To each of these, delivered as bad news, Claude chimes.
Marvellous.
He leans forward with a moan to tie his laces. She says,
"What did you do with the hat?"
She means my father's fedora with the broad brim.
"Didn't you see? I gave it to him."
"What did he do with it?"
"He had it in his hand when he left." "Don't worry. You're worried."
She sighs, thinks for a while.
"The police were so nice."
"Bereaved wife and all."
"I don't trust them."
"Just sit tight."
"They'll be back."
"Sit tight."
He delivers these two words with emphasis and a sinister break between them. Sinister or fractious. Now he's in the bathroom again, brushing his hair, no longer whistling. The air is changing. Trudy says,
"They want to talk to you."
"Of course, his brother."
"I told them about us."
There's a silence before he says,
"Bit dumb?"
Trudy clears her throat. Her tongue is dry.
"No, it isn't."
"Let them find out, or they'll think you're hiding something, trying to stay one step ahead."
"I told them John was depressed about us. One more reason for him to..."
"Okay. Okay, not bad. Might even be true. But..."
He trails away, uncertain of what it is he thinks she should know. That John Cairncross might have killed himself for love of her, if she hadn't killed him first. There's both pathos and guilt in this recursive notion. I think she doesn't like Claude's casual, even dismissive tone. Just my guess. However close you get to others, you can never get inside them, even when you're inside them. I think she's feeling wounded, but she says nothing yet. We both know it will come soon. The old question arises, how stupid is Claude really? From the bathroom mirror, he follows her thinking. He knows how to counter sentimentality in the matter of John Cairncross. He calls out,
"They'll be wanting to talk to that poet."
Summoning her is a balm. Every cell in Trudy's body concedes the death her husband owed. She hates Elodie more than she loves John. Elodie will be suffering. Blood-borne well-being sweeps through me, and I'm instantly high, thrown forwards by a surfer's perfect breaking wave of forgiveness and love. A tall, sloping, smoothly tubular wave that could carry me to where I might start to think fondly of Claude. But I resist it. How diminishing to accept at second hand my mother's every rush of feeling and be bound tighter to her crime. But it's hard to be separate from her when I need her. And with such churning of emotion, need translates to love, like milk to butter. She says in a sweet, reflective voice,
"Oh yes, they'll need to talk to Elodie."
Then she adds,
"Claude, you know I love you."
But he doesn't take this in. He's heard it too often. Instead, he says,
"Wouldn't mind being the proverbial fly on the wall."
Oh, proverbial fly, oh wall, when will he learn to speak without torturing me? Speaking's just a form of thinking, and he must be as stupid as he appears. Emerging from the bathroom's echo with a change of subject, he says lightly,
"I might have found us a buyer. A long shot, but I'll tell you later. Did the police leave their cards? I'd like to see their names."
She can't remember, and nor can I. Her mood is shifting again. I think she's staring at him fixedly as she says simply,
"He's dead."
It is indeed a startling fact.
barely believable, momentous, like a world war just declared, the Prime Minister speaking to the nation, families huddled together, and the lights gone dim for reasons the authorities won't disclose. Claude is standing close by her. His hand is on her thigh as he draws her to him. They kiss at length, in deep, with their tongues and tangled breath.
"As a doornail,"
he murmurs into her mouth. His erection is hard against my back. Then, whispering,
"We did it. Together. We're brilliant together."
"Yes," she says between the kisses. It's hard to hear for the rustling of clothes. Her enthusiasm may not be equal to his.
"I love you, Trudy."
"And I love you."
Something uncommitted about this, and... When she advanced, he retreated. Now, the reverse. This is their dance.
"Touch me."
Not quite a command, for his pleading voice is small. She tugs on the zip. Crime and sex. Sex and guilt. More dualities. The sinuous movement of her fingers is conveying pleasure. But not enough. He's pressing on her shoulders. She's going down on her knees, lowering herself, taking him, as I've heard them say, into her mouth. I can't imagine wanting such a thing for myself, but it's a lifted burden to have Claude satisfied many kindly inches away. It bothers me that what she swallows will find its way to me as nutrient, and make me just a little like him. Why else did cannibals avoid eating morons? It's over, quickly. With barely a gasp. He steps back and secures his zip. My mother swallows twice. He's offering nothing in return, and I think she doesn't want it. She steps past him, crosses the bedroom to the window, and stands there, her back to the bed. I think of her gazing out towards the tower blocks. My unhappy dream of a future there is nearer now. She repeats quietly, more to herself, for he's splashing once more in the bathroom.
"He's dead. Dead."
She doesn't seem convinced. And after several seconds, in a murmur,
"Oh, God."
Her legs are shaking. She's about to cry, but no, this is too serious for tears. She has yet to comprehend her own news. The twinned facts are huge, and she stands too close to see entirely the double horror. His death, and her part in it. I hate her and her remorse. How did she step from John to Claude, from poetry to dribbling cliché? Step down to the nasty sty to roll in filth with her idiot lover, lie in shit and ecstasy. Plan a house theft, inflict monstrous pain and a humiliating death on a kindly man. And now gasp and shiver at what she did, as if the murderess was someone else. Some sad sister fled from the locked ward with poison on the brain and out of control. An ugly, chain-smoking sister with sinister compulsions, the long-time family shame to be sighed for with "Oh God" and reverent whispering of my father's name. There she goes, in seamless transit, on the very same day and without a blush, from slaughter to self-pity. Claude appears behind her. The hands on her shoulders again are those of a man newly freed by orgasm, a man eager for practicalities and worldly speculation not compatible with a mind-fogging erection.
"You know what? I was reading the other day, and I've just realised... It's what we should have used. Diphenhydramine. Kind of antihistamine. People are saying the Russians used it on that spy they found locked in a sports bag. Poured it into his ear. Turned up the radiators before they left so the chemical dissolved in his tissues without a trace. Dumped the bag in the bath. Didn't want fluids dripping on the neighbours in the flat below."
"That's enough."
She doesn't say it sharply, more in resignation.
"Dead right. Enough's enough. We got there anyway."
He croons a snatch.
"The record shows we took the blows and did it our way."
The bedroom floorboards yield under my mother's feet. He's doing a little dance. She doesn't turn, but stands very still. She's hating him as much as I just hated her. Now he's at her side, sharing the view, trying to find her hand.
"Point is this," he says importantly. "They'll interview us separately. We should be lining up our stories. So, he came round this morning, for coffee, very depressed."
"I said we had a row."
"Okay, when?"
"Just as he was leaving."
"What about?"
"He wanted me to move out."
"Good. So, he came round this morning, for coffee, very depressed, and..."
She sighs, as I would. "Look, tell everything as it was, minus the smoothies, plus the row. Doesn't need a rehearsal."
"Okay. This evening. This evening I'll do the cups, the lot, across three locations. Another thing, he was wearing gloves the whole time."
"I know."
"And when you do the kitchen, not an atom of smoothie to..."
"I know."
He leaves her side to take a turn, a shuffle about the room. He senses success. He's restless, itchy, excited. That she isn't too boosts his impatience. There are things to do, and if not, things to plan. He wants to be out there. But where? He's half humming, half singing something new.
"My blue heaven, and baby makes three."
I'm not reassured. He's back by us, and she's rigid by the window, but he doesn't sense the danger.
"On the sail," he says, breaking off his song. "In my heart of hearts, I always thought we might need to take less than market price, just in case we have to make a quick..."
"Claude."
She mutters his name on two notes, the second lower than the first, a warning. But he pushes on. I've never known him happier or less likable.
"This guy's a builder, a developer. Doesn't even need to look around. Square footage is all. Flat, see? And cash in..."
She turns.
"Are you not even aware?"
"Of what?"
"Are you really so incredibly stupid?"
The very question. But Claude has switched moods too. He can sound dangerous.
"Let's hear it."
"It's escaped your attention."
"Clearly."
"Today. Just a few hours ago."
"Yes?"
"I lost my husband."
"No."
"The man I once loved, and who loved me, and who shaped my life, gave meaning to it."
A clenching in the sinews of her throat prevents her saying more. But Claude is launched.
"My darling little mouse, that's terrible. Lost, you say? Where could you have put him? Where did you have him last? You must have put him down somewhere."
"Stop it.
Lost. Let me think now. I know what. I've just remembered. You left him on the M1 by the edge of the road, lying on the grass with a gut full of poison. Fancy us forgetting that."
He might have gone on, but Trudy swings back her arm and hits him in the face. Not a lady's slap, but a clenched fist blow that levers my head from its mooring.
"You're full of spite," she says with surprising calm, "because you were always jealous."
"Well, well," says Claude, his voice only a little thickened. "The naked truth."
"You hated your brother because you could never be the man he was."
"While you loved him to the end."
Claude has reverted to fake wonderment.
"Now, what was that awfully clever thing someone was saying to me? Was it last night or the night before? I want him dead, and it has to be tomorrow. Not the loving wife of my brother, who shaped her life."
"You got me drunk. That's what you mostly do."
"And next morning, who was that proposing a toast to love, coaxing the man who shaped her life to raise a cup of venom? Surely not my brother's loving wife. Oh, no, not my own darling mouse."
I understand my mother. I know her heart. She's dealing with the facts as she sees them. The crime, once a sequence of plans and their enactment, now in memory resembles an object, unmovable, accusing, a cold stone statue in a clearing in a wood. A midwinter's bitter midnight, a waning moon, and Trudy is hurrying away down a frosty woodland path. She turns to look back at the distant figure, partly obscured by bare boughs and skeins of mist, and she sees that the crime, the object of her thoughts, is not a crime at all. It's a mistake. It always was. She suspected it all along. The further she removes herself, the clearer it becomes. She was merely wrong, not bad, and she's no criminal. The crime must be elsewhere in the woods and belong to someone else. No arguing with the facts that lead to Claude's essential guilt. His sneering tone can't protect him. It condemns him. And yet she violently wants him. Whenever he calls her his mouse, a curlicue of thrill, a cold contraction lodges in her perineum, an icy hook that tugs her downwards onto a narrow ledge and reminds her of the chasms she swooned into before, the walls of death she survived too often. His mouse! What humiliation! In the palm of his hand, pet, powerless, fearful, contemptible, disposable. Oh, to be his mouse! When she knows it's madness, so hard to resist, can she fight it? Is she a woman or a mouse? 13. A silence I can't read follows Claude's mockery. He may regret his sarcasm, or resent being diverted from his breezy upland of elation. She may be resentful too, or wanting to resume as his mouse. I'm weighing these possibilities as he moves away from her. He sits on the end of the disordered bed, tapping on his phone. She remains at the window, her back to the room, facing her portion of London, its diminishing evening traffic, scattered birdsong, lozenges of summer cloud, and chaos of roofs. When at last she speaks, her tone is sulky and flat. I'm not selling this house just so you can get rich. His reply is immediate. It's the same needling voice of derision. No, no, we'll be rich together. Or if you like, poor in separate prisons. It's nicely put as a threat. Can she believe him? That he'd take them both down? Negative altruism. Cutting off your nose to spite another's face. What should be her response? I have time to think, because she's yet to reply. A little shocked at this implied blackmail, I should say. Logically, she should suggest the same. In theory, they have equal power over each other. Leave this house, never come back, or I'll bring the police down on us both. But even I know that love doesn't steer by logic, nor is power distributed evenly. Lovers arrive at their first kisses with scars as well as longings. They're not always looking for advantage. Some need shelter. Others press only for the hyper-reality of ecstasy, for which they'll tell outrageous lies or make irrational sacrifice. But they rarely ask themselves what they need or want. Memories are poor for past failures. Childhoods shine through adult skin, helpfully or not. So do the laws of inheritance that bind a personality. The lovers don't know there's no free will. I haven't heard enough radio drama to know more than that, though pop songs have taught me that they don't feel in December what they felt in May, and that to have a womb may be incomprehensible to those who don't, and that the reverse is also true. Trudy turns to face the room. Her small, faraway voice chills me. I'm threatened. She already sees how their plans have gone wrong, despite signs of early success. She's shivering. Asserting her innocence isn't viable after all. The prospect of a fight with Claude has shown her how lonely her independence could be. His taste for sarcasm is new to her. It scares her, disorients her. And she wants him. Even though his voice, his touch, and his kisses are corrupted by what they've done. My father's death won't be confined. It's cut loose from its mortuary slab or stainless steel drawer and drifted in the evening air across the North Circular over those same North London roofs. It's in the room now, in her hair, on her hands, and on Claude's face, an illuminated mask that gapes without expression at the phone in his hand.
"Listen to this," he says in a Sunday breakfast sort of way. "From a local paper, tomorrow's. Body of a man seen by hard shoulder of M1 between junctions, etc. and etc. 1,200 calls from passing motorists to emergency services, etc. Man pronounced dead on arrival at hospital, confirms police spokeswoman, etc. Not yet named. And here's the thing, police are not treating the death as a criminal matter at this stage."
"At this stage," she murmurs. Then her voice picks up. "But you don't understand what I'm trying to..."
"Which is?"
"He's dead. Dead. It's so... And..." Now she's starting to cry. "And it hurts."
Claude is merely reasonable. "What I understand is you wanted him dead, and now..."
"Oh, John!" she cries.
"So we'll stick our courage to the screwing, whatever, and get on with..."
"We've done a terrible thing," she says, oblivious to the break she's making with innocence.
"Ordinary people wouldn't have the guts to do what we've done. So, here's another one. Luton Herald and Post. Yesterday morning..."
"Don't! Please don't!"
"All right, all right. Same stuff anyway."
Now she's indignant. "They write dead man and it's nothing to them, just words, typing. They've no idea what it means."
"But they're right. I happen to know this. Around the world, 105 people die every minute. Not far off 2 a second. Just to give you some perspective."
2 seconds pause as she takes this in. Then she begins to laugh. An unwanted, mirthless laugh that turns to sobbing, through which she manages to say at last, "I hate you." He's come close. His hand is on her arm. He murmurs into her ear.
"Hate. Don't get me excited all over again."
But she has. Through his kisses and her tears, she says, "Please, no. Claude." She doesn't turn or push him away. His fingers are below my head, moving slowly. "Oh, no," she whispers, moving closer to him. "Oh, no." Grief and sex?
I can only theorize.
Defenses weak, soft tissues gone softer, emotional resilience yielding to childish trust in salty abandonment. I hope never to find out. He has pulled her towards the bed, removed her sandals, her cotton summer dress, and called her his mouse again, though only once. He pushes her onto her back. Consent has rough edges. Does a grieving woman grant it when she raises her buttocks so her panties are pulled free? I'd say no. She has rolled onto her side, the only initiative she takes. Meanwhile, I'm working on a plan. A gesture of last resort. My last shot. He's kneeling by her, probably naked. At such a time, what could be worse? He swiftly presents the answer. The high medical risk, at this stage of pregnancy, of the missionary position. With a muttered command, how he charms, he turns her on her back, parts her legs with an indifferent backhand, and gets ready, so the mattress tells me, to lower his bulk onto mine. My plan? Claude is tunnelling towards me, and I must be quick. We're swaying, creaking, under great pressure. A high-pitched electronic sound wails in my ears, my eyes bulge and smart. I need the use of my arms, my hands, but there's so little room. I'll say it fast. I'm going to kill myself. An infant death. A homicide, in effect, due to my uncle's reckless assault on a gravid woman well advanced in her third trimester. His arrest, trial, sentence, imprisonment, my father's death half avenged. Half, because murderers don't hang in gentle Britain. I'll give Claude a proper lesson in the art of negative altruism. To take my life,
I'll need the cord, 3 turns around my neck of the mortal coil. I hear from far off my mother's sighs. The fiction of my father's suicide will be the inspiration for my own attempt. Life imitating art. To be stillborn, a tranquil term purged of tragedy, has a simple allure. Now hears the thudding against my skull. Claude is gaining speed, now at a gallop, hoarsely breathing. My world is shaking, but my noose is in place, both hands are gripping. I'm pulling down hard, back-bent, with a bell-ringer's devotion. How easy! A slippery tightening against the common carotid, vital channel beloved of slit throats. I can do it! Harder! A sensation of giddy toppling, of sound becoming taste, touch becoming sound, a rising blackness, blacker than I've ever seen, and my mother murmuring her farewells. But of course to kill the brain is to kill the will, to kill the brain. As soon as I start to fade, my fists go limp, and life returns. Immediately I hear signs of robust life. Intimate sounds, as through the walls of a cheap hotel. Then louder, louder. It's my mother. There she goes, launched on one of her perilous thrills. But my own prison wall of death's too high. I've fallen back into the exercise yard of dumb existence. Finally, Claude withdraws his revolting weight. I salute his crude brevity. And my space is restored, though I've pins and needles in my legs. Now I'm recovering, while Trudy lies back, limp with exhaustion, and all the usual regrets. It's not the theme parks of Paradiso and Inferno that I dread most, the heavenly rides, the hellish crowds. And I could live with the insult of eternal oblivion. I don't even mind not knowing which it will be. What I fear is missing out. Healthy desire or mere greed, I want my life first, my due, my infinitesimal slice of endless time, and one reliable chance of a consciousness. I'm owed a handful of decades to try my luck on a free-wheeling planet. That's the ride for me, the wall of life. I want my go. I want to become. Put another way, there's a book I want to read, not yet published, not yet written, though a start's been made. I want to read to the end of my history of the 21st century. I want to be there, on the last page, in my early 80s, frail but sprightly, dancing a jig on the evening of December 31st, 2099. It might end before that date, and so it's a thriller of sorts, violent, sensational, highly commercial. A compendium of dreams with elements of horror. But it's bound to be a love story, too, and a heroic tale of brilliant invention. For a taste, look at the prequel, The 100 Years Before. A grim read, at least until halfway, but compelling. A few redeeming chapters on, say, Einstein and Stravinsky. In the new book, one of many unresolved plot lines is this. Will its 9 billion heroes scrape through without a nuclear exchange? Think of it as a contact sport. Line up the teams. India versus Pakistan, Iran versus Saudi Arabia, Israel versus Iran, USA versus China, Russia versus USA and NATO, North Korea versus the rest. To raise the chances of a score, add more teams. The non-state players will arrive. How determined are our heroes to overheat their hearth? A cosy 1.6 degrees, the projection or hope of a sceptical few, will open up the tundra to mountains of wheat, Baltic beachside tavernas, lurid butterflies in the Northwest Territory.